For the week of November 7th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 78, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And at the Pop-Tarts store in Times Square, I'm Michael Giltz.
What? There's a Pop-Tarts?
There's
Pop-Tarts
a store devoted to Pop-Tarts, Kellogg Pop-Tarts, t-shirts, caps, shoes. I'm stunned. I'm still stunned.
Oh my God, that's the best thing I've ever heard of.
I thought the M&M store was the sign of the apocalypse, but I think a Pop-Tart store is even more of a sign.
Well, we'll have to discuss later on whether you think a college course on Lady Gaga is the end of the world. That's going to be coming up in Big Deal or Big Whoop. But we have kind of a nerdy show for you today because a lot of our stories focus on the business of the business. And of course, the business we're speaking of is the business of show, which we discuss every week. We're going to bring you up to speed on what's going on at MGM, the once legendary studio, which filed for bankruptcy protection this past week. Then we're going to talk to Todd Weaver, who is the head of IVI.TV, a controversial new startup which is streaming broadcast signals and copyrighted programming over the internet. I'm sure there's not going to be anything wrong with that. Taylor Swift is making news again, thanks to her new hit record. And we are sure to argue, discuss, whether News Corp's newspaper paywall is a hit or a miss now that they've provided some financial figures. Of course, we'll go over most of the major headlines when we play Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who, when he's not writing about entertainment for the Huffington Post and others, drops by to give his opinion on the latest entertainment news. He's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right, and the number one movie at the box office this week is Megamind, a new animated film starring the voices of Will Ferrell, Tina Fey, and Brad Pitt, who does a great imitation of George Clooney, as far as I'm concerned. It grossed $47.6 million, and it's the number one movie, a strong debut for the film from DreamWorks. At number two is Due Date, the comedy starring Robert Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis. That grossed $33.5 million. And at number three, Tyler Perry, who is Money in the Bank. His movie For Colored Girls, based on the classic play, grossed $20.1 million. It's his biggest budget movie to date. It cost $21 million, but they've made it back in an opening weekend, basically, so always a good sign. And number four, showing some great legs again, is Red, the film starring Bruce Willis and Helen Mirren. It grossed $8.8 million and is at $71 million total. Saw 3D made another $8 million. That's at $38 million total, but it's falling fast. Paranormal Activity 2 is right behind it at $7.2 million. That's at $77 million total. Jackass 3D is still in there at $5 million. It's grossed more than $110 million in the U.S. alone. Hereafter, the Clint Eastwood film is falling very hard. It's at $28 million total and about to fall out of the top 10. Secretariat, the Disney horse movie, is at $50 million total. And at number 10 is The Social Network, the Oscar hopeful, which has now hit $85 million total. I saw the Pee Wee Herman show on Broadway right before I went to get a Pop-Tart. So that's what I did this weekend. Did you guys see any movies?
No, I was in Palm Springs this weekend.
Oh, doing what?
Nothing.
Were you golfing?
Nope.
I'm trying to pry into your private life. Were you golfing?
There is no. I was there with my sister and we did nothing but sit around by the pool and eat a lot and drink a lot. And the place we stayed is right next to the Parker, which for people who don't know, Palm Springs is one of the nicer hotels there.
You had an address right next to a really nice address.
Isn't that weird? I could actually afford it.
You were Parker adjacent.
I was Parker adjacent.
What about you, Sperling?
I actually saw a screening of Megamind last week, which was okay. I don't necessarily think it's a great movie. It really felt somewhat hackneyed, like we'd seen it before. And indeed, we had seen it before with The Incredibles and then
Despicable Me.
Despicable Me earlier this year. It really felt a lot like Despicable Me, frankly.
Yeah, even when the trailers were playing, they looked very similar. And I thought, ooh, I'm glad I'm not second in that race. You know, you want to have your movie out first.
Yeah, but, you know, it made $47.6 million in its opening weekend, which a lot of people feel, a lot of the entertainment pundits felt, well, that's not really a lot of money for a film like that. They expected it to do better. It did better than How to Train Your Dragon, which opened earlier this year to $43.7 million. And it did.
And had great legs.
And yes, Anne had great legs.
Every time you say that, I think about when we were talking about Meryl Streep and her great legs.
She has great legs.
Not that kind of.
Yeah, I think you can only.
I know.
I think you can only. She has great legs, period. I think you can only look at a $47 million opening for Megamind as a strong, solid opening. You know, once that, it's up to the movie. But that, they opened the film. That's, you can't dismiss that as sort of weak.
What a disappointment, though, for Due Date.
Yeah, they're kind of looking at that as a disappointment.
$33 million total? You guys are crazy.
But it's got Zach Galifianakis, whatever.
Who is not a movie star.
No.
Not movie star, but the kids love him. And
Robert Downey Jr. And it opened it's two guys in a car and it grossed $33 million. What's wrong with that?
I bet they're disappointed. I bet they really hope that movie was going to open.
How much more should it have opened at? It grossed about $10,000 per screen. It was on 3,300 screens.
47,000? I mean, 47 million?
It cost $65 million to make.
It got beat by a cartoon.
An animated film, thank you very much.
Sorry.
Well, nobody can argue that For Colored Girls had a solid opening. It's slightly down from his Madea movies, but it's still a very strong opening. Tyler Perry brings in the audience first week. Typically, it falls off a cliff after that, but they make their money back because they're so inexpensive. This did cost $20 million, but if he just doubles what he made, you know, if he makes $40 million, then they'll be in the black, I think.
Oh, this movie got terrible reviews, though.
All of his movies do.
Well, now, Michael, you just mentioned a moment ago the per-screen average of $10,000 per screen for Due Date. What I am discovering is that if you look at most of the box office charts, they will have Megamind at $47.6 million, and their theater count is 3,944 for a per-screen average of $12,082.
Now, and that's really per location is what you're going to say.
Yes, exactly. It's per location because really Megamind played on 7,300 screens, which actually gives it a $6,527 per screen average.
Well, that's fair. But I think in this day and age when you can expand and decrease your actual screen count from minute to minute, or you move it from one theater to the other with a flip of a switch, I think that might be a more accurate, better way to think about it going ahead. Because there are so many, it used to be in the old days, you just had one screen in a theater. Now we've got multiplexes. So, but like claiming it's in 7,000 locations isn't really, you know, they throw it on an extra screen in one multiplex and it adds up a whole new theater. It just means there's overflow. I think maybe the 12,000 is a pretty fair breakdown of what it did per theater, but you're right. It's a new way of thinking about it.
Well, compare that to 127 Hours, the James Franco film that Danny Boyle directed, which people are passing out in apparently during the amputation scene.
I love that. I'd probably be one of them, trust me.
Well, that opened on four screens this week and earned $266,000 or a $66,500 per screen average. That's a lot.
But that's because it's on four screens. Now, is that four screens or four locations?
Four screens. Well, okay, pardon me, four locations.
Right, exactly. But yeah, no, that's what you would expect to see with a movie with a relatively big star in a high-profile movie. The director's coming off the biggest hit of his career. I mean, movies, when they open on one or two screens right around Christmas, they tend to get big, first week at least, they tend to get really big averages.
Well, last week we talked about these kind of weird trumpeting statements made around box office. And this week, Megamind boasted the broadest release yet for a 3D illusion. So that's coming from Box Office Mojo. It was in 2,634 locations, and 66% of the gross came from 3D.
So that's falling quite a bit.
Yeah, well, it's kind of evening out between 60 and 75. So, yeah. And they're now saying that, you know, Due Date had the highest grossing opening ever for an R-rated comedy in November, topping Borat. And it's the eighth biggest rated R opening of all time. And I just love the way they're like, just they're stretching
R-rated comedy is a bit of a stretch, but eighth biggest of all time, not doing it by month, is saying something. And there you go. It's $33 million. It's an R-rated comedy. It's two guys in a car. And it was the eighth biggest R-rated comedy of all time. But people say, oh, that's disappointing.
Well, for Megamind, the papers were full of, and the internet was full of, the fact that it beat A Christmas Carol, which opened this weekend last year, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and Despicable Me, I guess it didn't beat, because that opened to $56.4 million. It also fell short of another DreamWorks film, Monsters vs. Aliens, which opened in 2009 to nearly $60 million. But here's what I find interesting. It opened on the first week of November, Megamind that is, and so did The Incredibles back in 2004, and half the number of people saw Megamind in its opening weekend that saw The Incredibles, or then saw The Incredibles.
Okay, so why do you think that is?
That's kind of what is fascinating to me. Why did half the audience for children's films or family entertainment disappear?
But The Incredibles opened to $70 million, and it came from Pixar, which is the Tyler Perry of animated movie brands. I mean, Pixar is money in the bank. They're the most dependable family drawing label out there right now, more than almost any director or star or anything.
Right, but it made $70 million without the 3D surcharge.
Right, you're saying less people went to see Megamind. Of course they did. It got terrible reviews. And
It got terrible reviews?
And it was on 3D, so it cost more to see and fewer people went. Incredibles got the best reviews of the year, practically, from a terrifically trusted company, and it delivered. So, of course, more people went. And comparing different movies is, again, it's always a little silly. All that matters is how much did it cost to make the movie, and at the end of the day, how much does it gross on film worldwide and DVD?
Yeah, but what I think that Sperling was getting at is that it was going after the same audience. And he's saying, where did they go? And I think that your point is a good one. The reviews had been different. And also, I would argue that The Incredibles was something kind of new at the time.
Yeah. And this movie is in 3D, so it costs more to take your kids if you want to do the 3D stuff.
That is very, very true.
That's another, that's why it's, you know, so many people, families are really resisting. Every animated film is 3D, and families are really bucking against that trend. They should be happy they got 66% of the people to pony up. But I bet people decided not to go because they just said, well, if I see it in 2D, I'm missing something and I don't want to pay the premium. They don't want to argue with their kids about it.
Well, a moment ago, you mentioned that Tyler Perry was money in the bank and that film Four Colored Girls made $20 million and is a Lionsgate film. And at one point, Lionsgate was rumored or in talks to take over MGM, the legendary studio started by, and of course, Michael, you're going to have to fill me in here. I know Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford, and Errol Flynn.
Well, that's United Artists.
Never mind. It's MGM UA. I always kind of lump
them
together.
Yes, they did merge together many years ago, but United Artists was founded by those people that you mentioned. MGM is Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, you know.
And one of them was Louis B. Mayer, who did found Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, which filed for bankruptcy protection last Wednesday morning after it could no longer pay down its crippling debt or make and release new movies, which is what it did as its business.
Well, you make it sound like this is a crisis moment. This is a good step forward. They've been in crisis for quite a few years now, and they've finally been able to get all the creditors and people to come together and agree on a plan to move forward. This is important to people who love movies because it means, A, we already saw that the Lord of the Rings prequel, The Hobbit, is happening, and now there's talk about James Bond being ready for 2012. So now all the properties that have been tangled up in this mess are getting freed up, and hopefully they'll be able to move forward and do something with their library and the name brand that's MGM.
And speaking of name brands, corporate raider Carl Icahn had to strike a deal because he's one of MGM's leading creditors, apparently, and he had amassed about 15% of the company's debt and was at one point pushing for Lionsgate and MGM to merge. And of course, he tried to take over Lionsgate, and now it doesn't look as if he's going to do that. I guess he's backed off of that now.
Right, but he'll make his money.
But instead, looks like Spyglass Entertainment will now run MGM. Gary Barber and Roger Birnbaum, the heads of that kind of a financing production company. They're, you know, MGM, $4 billion in debt, and the company's valued at $1.9 billion. Those numbers are a little upside down.
It sounds like my finances.
Huh. You're $4 billion in debt?
No, but the ratio. He's talking about the ratio. Yeah, I started to get really bored of this story right until Spyglass got involved, like, in a serious level. And I was like, wow, this got interesting again.
Wait, why is Spyglass getting involved with MGM interesting?
Maybe it's just because Spyglass has been around for a long time. And I mean, I remember them so well when I first was working in this business. It's just, to me, they came out of nowhere. And I'm sure that obviously wasn't the case. There had to have been a connection somewhere. But I don't know. It was just interesting getting, like, new, familiar to me names involved in this because I was getting really sick of hearing about Icahn and MGM. I just didn't care anymore. And then all of a sudden, it was like, whoa, we're bringing in the Spyglass guys? Where'd this come from?
And that potential merger with Lionsgate is not completely off the table. They have agreed to negotiate in good faith with Lionsgate about a potential merger down the road.
I think that together they would probably all be worth much more as one than as the separate entities that they are.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to television.
Yes, I actually was trolling the internet this week, as I always do, and saw an article about how I could watch television on my iPad, which if you have an iPad, like Karen does, you can't watch Hulu unless you pay. And so, of course, I clicked on the link and I learned all about IVI.TV. And joining us is Todd Weaver, the CEO of IVI TV. Todd, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no problem at all.
Can you tell us a little bit about what IVI.TV does, when it started, and what your goals are?
Yeah, sure. The company's name is actually pronounced Ivy, but the domain is IVI.TV. We actually started about 2005. We do live internet television. In 2005, we started out to really solve the technological hurdles of distributing live TV over the internet, and then accomplishing those hurdles, which are really a problem of scale, a problem of security, and a problem of ease of use. We incorporated in 2007 to become an online cable system. So very much the same business model as cable or satellite, with the exception that we don't ship a van to your home and drill inside of your wall and then sell you a set-top box. Instead, you can download that to really any internet-connected device. We incorporated in 2007 and actually set out to gain contracts for all the cable channels and broadcast channels and even international channels. And, hit a number of roadblocks with existing distribution contracts and some other pain points for a lot of the channels that are out there. And then we launched, basically put together our go-to-market strategy and launched with all the major over-the-air broadcast channels out of New York and Seattle, the same as about 16,000 other cable companies that carry over-the-air broadcast to subscribing members. And we knew that was going to create quite a stir because we didn't actually go out and expressly get permission to carry those over-the-air broadcast channels.
Well, in fact, when you first launched, broadcasters kind of balked, and they asked IVTV to cease and desist, and you kind of immediately, IVTV kind of had a countersuit, since they didn't sue you, but kind of an anticipatory lawsuit, and you filed that in federal district court in Seattle, where you're based.
Right. So the brief history of copyright kind of lays into our entire go-to-market strategy. That when cable first came out, they actually were in the exact same chicken and egg problem that we were in, which is that they've laid an infrastructure. In our case, we've created a very revolutionary technology. And the satellite later had the same issue. So cable, when they first came out, they laid this infrastructure but needed to get premium content. And what they did is they captured the over-the-air broadcast channels, and they carried those to subscribing members of their service and who were, outside the area, who couldn't receive the signals from over-the-air or in market even. And
TBS in Atlanta, for example. I remember they were one of the first local channels that became a powerhouse because they were carried on cable stations all over the country.
Yeah, that's right. And so in the case of over the air broadcast, then the broadcasters sued cable and went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said this is not copyright infringement. And then Congress stepped in and enacted what's called the compulsory licensing. Okay, 16,000 cable companies pay under the compulsory licensing scheme to give permission to carry over-the-air broadcast channels. Okay, so then satellite, about 20 years after that, comes along, and they are in the same chicken and egg. They shoot satellites in space, but they need to be able to get premium content, and they can't negotiate those rights because of contractual inhibitors, number of subscribers, and so on and so forth. So what they do is they capture the over-the-air broadcast channels and retransmit them, and they pay the compulsory licensing. Broadcasters freak out again, and they sue them. It goes to district court, and district court states, this is not copyright infringement. A satellite company is defined as a cable system under the U.S. copyright law, so everything's on the up and up. And then Congress stepped in and said, well, we're actually going to enact a secondary compulsory licensing specifically to satellite. So for us, we come along, we're a third distribution, which is live broadcast TV over the internet. And, of course, broadcasters freaked out. So as soon as we launched, we knew that while we have actually talked to pretty much every cable channel out there, and we've talked to since 2007, talking to every cable channel, a lot of the broadcast channels, to basically be able to carry their channels. And the existing cable channels are tied up in a massive Gordian knot of legal and where they can and cannot carry content, a lot of which actually comes directly from Comcast's specific contracts with those channels that they can't carry their linear feed on the internet. So we beat the chicken and egg the same way cable did once they came out, the same way that satellite did, and we knew that it was going to become a problem And really what that problem actually is that has nothing to do with copyright, even though that's the only thing that the broadcasters, in this case what we call big media, the big media has the ability to have a complaint against our company. It happens to only be with copyright, but there's no real case there. So the whole thing is that the FCC doesn't govern the internet. The FCC is what governs cable companies and satellite companies that they have to negotiate for retransmission consent, okay? And then there's also a massive amount of benefits that you get from the FCC, primarily that you can carry other channels for a competitive price. So they have to negotiate with you. If we had, so the whole thing breaks down that the left hand of the government is U.S. copyright law, which we are completely in compliance to. And then the right hand of the government is the FCC, which governs retransmission consent and the benefit for us to be able to get other channels at a competitive price. So we've actually lobbied to the FCC to be carried as a cable system defined by the FCC so we can get those benefits where we can pay retransmission consent, negotiate a contract in good faith to carry these channels, and the FCC says, no, we don't govern the internet. So instead what we've done is basically launched where we pay for the compulsory licensing into the U.S. copyright law, like 16,000 other cable companies, but we don't have the governance of the FCC that's forcing us to negotiate retransmission consent.
You want to be covered under the secondary transmission law. Is that correct?
No, that's a myth. We actually, the secondary transmission or secondary retransmission under the U.S. copyright law is something that's actually designed for like booster signals, right? Like an antenna that's outside the market that's going to capture and boost the signal to another market. So that's called a passive carrier exemption. So we pay under the compulsory licensing, which is specifically the cable system definition under U.S. copyright law. As long as we carry the transmission in a linear fashion, right, to subscribing members, over wires, cable, or other communication, right? It's very broad. It's broad on purpose. So that way, even satellite, from a court's interpretation of the law, was classified as a cable system. And even in the U.S. copyright law actually also states that you can be defined as a cable system under U.S. copyright law while you are not defined as a cable company under the FCC. And so they've actually made that distinction written in the law itself. And if you really just go to the top level of the Supreme Court has even stated, as regards to copyright, that the day that technology advances beyond copyright, you must side on the side of distribution instead of content restriction. So we know all this going into it, but the broadcasters still, when we first launched, we received cease and desist letters.
And to break it down for our listeners, if you go online right now, you can go to ivi.tv and find out that you can get live streaming, live television over the internet for about $5 a month. You're going to be adding stuff like DVR capability down the road. And basically your argument is that, look, some people pay for television by getting cable sent into their home. Some people get television over satellite. And today, now, people want to be able to pay for television over the internet. And that's what you're offering. And the networks legally are going to have to deal with you, all the cable channels, and strike some deals so that you can offer this service to people because they want it and you're providing it.
That's right. And we are negotiating those deals with cable channels because obviously we can't just carry and retransmit those. We only do that for broadcast.
And do you have more money set aside for lawsuits than you do for your technology? Because I think for the first little bit, that seems like more what you're going to have to deal with.
Yeah. So, yes, of course, we knew all of it going into it. And really, it's a copyright lawsuit. So it is something that's a manageable number. It's something that's calculable. We have the ability to handle the suit over the course of time. Right? It's just initially we get past the preliminary injunction, and then that's the next stage where we happen to be. And then if it goes to a case here in Seattle, it'll be about a year and a half. If it goes to New York, maybe about 2 years. It's not an immediate cash drain. It's something that is, a drain over the course of time, and it's something that's managed and planned for.
And the biggest challenge for you is to make sure that you'll be able to carry channels while these lawsuits go forward, because obviously you want to be able to, for the next 3 years, sign up subscribers and keep showing them these channels that you have from New York and Seattle and others that you may add down the road.
So, we actually just added two channels from LA and more are going to be coming on this next week. So that's the third market we're bringing on, and then Chicago's going to follow. But what you bring up is what's called the preliminary injunction. So after getting past the preliminary injunction, that basically means the lights are on or the lights are off during the duration of the case.
Exactly. Well, good luck with the court battles, and people can go to IVI.tv to check out more information on getting television over the internet. And we look forward to hearing from you down the road.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And that was Todd Weaver, the CEO of IVTV, apparently not IVI-TV, which streams television over the internet. Karen, I was surprised that you didn't have anything to say there. I thought for sure the television buff that you are.
One of my clients is involved in the case.
There you go. She recused herself. Very well done. Much better than a Supreme Court justice like have done in the past. So I appreciate that.
Well, is Disney a client?
No.
Well, Disney this week, kind of talking about this whole merging of traditional media and traditional means of distribution and digital means of distribution, they kind of merged their television distribution into home entertainment.
This doesn't surprise me at all, because the home entertainment sections in all departments, I guess, departments in all of the studios are all being folded in somewhere. Haven't you noticed that?
Yeah, I remember 5 years ago, whatever, the big debate was, you know, the different little empires for DVD versus movie. And then they finally realized they should be integrated. It's silly. It's crazy, especially as release dates for DVDs get closer and closer to the theatrical. It's one big campaign. And so there's no reason not to merge in television as well.
And also it saves them costs. I mean, I don't think they just say, hey, we're going to put all these people, you know, all in, yeah, in this room now. No, they're getting rid of people. So they're saving money.
Well, and they continue to restructure over at Disney.
Restructure.
Well, re-engineer.
Fire people.
Yeah, fire people.
Right. As well, if you get something, you know, I've seen mega companies like this. They'll have somebody write some press release for their TV show, and then somebody else will write the press release for when it goes out on DVD, and then someone else will write the same press release over again for, you know, they just waste a lot of time and effort and energy by having three different PR companies and three different people writing the same basic description of a show for a new iteration of it. You know, it's available for sale on iTunes. They pay someone else to write that. It's like you can use one thing for all of them. You know, you put it all together. It just makes a lot more sense.
Well, does it make sense that The Daily Show with Jon Stewart is beating both Leno on The Tonight Show and Letterman on The Late Show for the first time ever?
It doesn't surprise me for a second.
In the Prime demo.
In the Prime demo, of course. That's,
which is,
I mean, what else
would
we
talk about?
18 to 49.
Yeah, that just doesn't surprise me at all. In other words, everyone who watches TV for the most part.
Yeah, that's at that hour, yeah.
Well, but this is the first time it's ever happened.
No,
it should be a little surprising.
This is great.
Obviously, it comes on the heels. He did it in October. For the month of October, he scored more viewers in the 18 to 49 demo. He had 1.3 million viewers average for the month of October versus Leno's 1.2 million and Letterman's 1.2 million. Colbert Report was down to 900,000 and so on. Obviously, he had the big rally in Washington.
Well, that helped, but this is how people are getting their news, you know? It's like people don't come to him just because he's a comedian. People are getting their news from The Daily Show.
Yeah.
So this is why he's getting two different, you know, types of people. The people who like him because he's funny. Three, actually. The people who like him because he's funny. The people who like his politics. And the people who get their news that way.
Yeah, and it's not really news. I mean, he's kind of making fun of the news.
Oh, but this is how somebody, when I was in grad school, somebody wrote their thesis on this, that younger demos now are watching The Daily Show to get their news, period.
They want to be entertained. And
I've always thought you couldn't enjoy the show much unless you were already reading some of the news information out there. I've always felt
like
you enjoy it more.
I agree, but that's not
view.
The way that people are, that all people are watching this show. People are watching it who don't have the context.
Well,
they don't.
But then they're getting
the
virtually
jokes.
No news because there's very little news on the show. Very little.
That's actually not true.
People always say
that's not true.
It's just not true.
It's not true.
It is true. There's they cover like two stories a show.
Watch the show sometime and act.
I watch the show every single night.
No, but
and they cover.
But you're smart and you listen to the news and you watch and you read the news. You know what's going on. Watch the show.
Yeah,
a couple of nights.
The number of stories that they cover is extremely small. They'll cover Obama's India trip, and that will be a 5-minute segment. Then they'll cover something else.
I'm not saying that people get a really good idea of what all the news is, but that is how people are getting their news.
But they're getting known. It's not a source for the daily news of what happened in the day. So to say they get their news that way,
they are.
When that's not what they do,
it's
counterintuitive. It doesn't make any sense. They can't get their news from the show because the show does not provide headlines of the day's news.
They cover
two or three stories in a funny way.
I'm not disagreeing with you. But what I'm saying is that it has been proven. Studies have shown that people are getting their news this way. Younger people are getting their news this way.
Well, perhaps the way to say it is that the only news they're aware of is stuff that's joked about on the Jon Stewart show.
But they go to the Daily Show to get their dose of the news.
And I go to Letterman because he's beating Jay Leno now on The Tonight Show.
He did for one for this month.
When will these shows go away? Don't you see that happening sometime in the near future?
Let's see. Conan O'Brien's first show on TBS is tonight. So no, I don't think it's going. Yeah. I don't think they're going away. I just think that their viewership will fall.
But Conan
over time.
Is different.
Well, they have fallen for decades.
I think the future is what Conan is doing.
But it's just the same show at 11.
I know, but it's on TBS, and he's all over the internet. I mean, what he can do is different, and he can take more risks than you can if you're on NBC.
Well, and the Stewart Show is on. Well, there's room for both. I mean, there's room for Letterman and room for Bill Maher. There's room for the Sunday morning shows on the ABC, and there's room for Bill Maher on HBO.
I just think that the network late night shows will eventually age themselves out.
Well, and you have 9 shows listed here, from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart all the way through to Lopez Tonight, which has 450,000 average viewers on any given night.
On TBS. So if you're wondering why George Lopez lobbied Conan and said, no, I want you to come to TBS. You won't be displacing me like Jay Leno did you. Now you know why. He'd like a nice big fat, show getting big ratings leading into his show.
Speaking of things that are nice, big, and fat, Taylor Swift.
What?
What?
Did you just call Taylor Swift fat?
No, but I thought that was a perfect segue to kind of like see whether you were paying attention or not.
I'm completely paying attention.
Okay, well, now that you're paying attention, Taylor Swift is not fat. In fact, if she turns sideways, you can barely see her.
Her bank account is fat.
Her bank account is fat after this week.
Well, because her new album, Speak Now, debuted in stores, and it sold more than 1 million copies in its first week.
You like her?
That's more than the next 61 albums combined. The number 2 album of the week, in contrast, was by the country band Sugarland, and they sold 89,000 copies, as opposed to 1.04 million copies. It's the first album to go platinum in a week since Lil Wayne did it in 2008. It's only happened 16 times in history. I mean, it set a lot of records, especially in the declining sales world that we live in. It's their largest 1 week total since 50 Cent sold 1.1 million copies in 2005.
Do you like Taylor Swift?
You know, she's such a poor singer live. I sort of resist her, but I'm trying to listen to her music and give it a shot. I'm not a big fan, certainly not.
Are you going to watch?
Absolutely.
So am I. I'm really looking forward to it. I love the performances.
When there's a lot of reasons why the album debuted so well, obviously the reviews were strong. She's everywhere, literally. She'd already had 2 top 10 hits off the album. She's the biggest star in the world right now, really, as far as album sales and attention, and she won the Grammy for Album of the Year. I mean, it just doesn't get any bigger than this right now. But still, she joins pretty select company. I mean, NSYNC did it twice. The Beatles have done it. Eminem's done it twice. The Backstreet Boys have done it twice. And then you've got other artists like Garth Brooks, Whitney Houston, Britney Spears, Norah Jones, Usher, and Limp Bizkit. That's it. No one else in history has ever sold more than 1 million copies in a week since the SoundScan era began in 1991, and they were able to track sales directly.
Now, we keep talking about how big Taylor Swift is, and not physically, but in stature. So, and everybody's talking
Actually,
about that.
Actually, she's pretty tall.
Well, I meant, thank you very much, Karen. But how are we going to cover this story in a way that mainstream media is not?
How could we possibly bring something new to it? Well, I read coverage in the New York Times, USA Today, The Hollywood Reporter, even Billboard, and nobody mentioned, I think, the most salient fact here. It doesn't take away from what she accomplished, but the fact is that on Amazon.com, the second largest music retailer in the country, iTunes is number one, her album was sold as a digital copy for how much? $4. $4. They had a huge sale on it. I bought it for $4. I was thinking, do I need to buy this CD? I don't know. And then I saw that Amazon had it for $4. I said, oh, well, for $4, I'll pay it. Now, that doesn't mean it's not a big deal that she sold 1 million copies. But if 10% or 15 or 20% of her sales came from that $4 thing, that's certainly something people should have pointed out. I couldn't believe nobody mentioned the fact that the second biggest retailer in the country was discounting the album so immensely.
So it's kind of like a 3D film making a huge gross or earning a huge gross over a weekend, and then you find out later, well, it's because it was 3D and actually fewer people saw that than the second.
Than the other movie.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the album costs $14 at Walmart or $14 on Amazon on CD. On iTunes, it costs $14 digitally, but it was $4 on Amazon.com. I mean, and this is the hottest act in the world. So when you talk about artists need to make their money on touring and all these other things, and what price should albums be? It's not like they sold the album for $4 for some new rising talent they wanted to convince you to give a try. This is the biggest star in the world, and they sold her album for $4. That's got to devalue what people are willing to pay for everybody else, because nothing is in more demand than Taylor Swift right now. She's been the best-selling artist for the last 2 or 3 years. So when U2 comes out with a new album, they say, we want $14, $15 for it digitally. People are going to resist. They're going to say, why? How about that Taylor Swift album for $4? It's big news, I think.
Well, what will be big news in 2 weeks is Kanye West will kind of probably show her up when he releases his next album. It's due out November 22nd in North America.
Well, he won't sell 1 million copies. He's never done it before. Maybe he will, but I doubt it.
What's the deal with his diamond teeth?
I don't know. Would you buy Taylor Swift's album for $4, Karen?
Yeah, I might, actually. I'm not a fan, but I'm not a fan. I'm not familiar. I mean, I know her hits, but I'm not familiar enough with her music. But a lot of people I know really like her. I don't know. I think she's going to perform at the CMAs, right? I'd be very surprised if she wasn't.
Yes, yes.
We'll see. God, that'll be a fun train wreck, won't it? Do you remember when she performed with Stevie Nicks? Was it at the AMAs? The Grammys or something?
Grammys.
Oh, man, it was such a disaster. It was awesome.
You mentioned that $4 is a little too low, Michael.
I don't think it's necessarily too low, but I'm saying that's a whole new ball game. When you take the biggest selling act in the world and sell their new album for $4, that is the headline. Not the fact that you sold 1 million copies, but that it was on sale for such a cheap amount. That's unbelievable.
Right, and it sets a precedent. But how much would you pay for the news? Or a newspaper?
I don't know. You know, my problem is you're talking about paywalls going up for the New York Times and a lot of other companies around the world that are saying, hey, why are we giving our newspaper away for free online? And my attitude is, I would be willing to pay for like the New York Times or maybe the Times of London. I'm not sure how much, but as long as all the other companies are available, I'm not ready to do it. If the New York Times puts up a paywall, I'll go to the LA Times, to the Washington Post, to BBC.com.
So you're saying everybody has to do it at once. All in or nothing.
And this is where they really screwed themselves, because it's almost too late to turn back now.
Right. And what we're talking about here is the next story, which is about the Times of London. They released some figures this week about, since their paywall went up in June, how many people have subscribed. And it looks like 150,000 scale the Times digital wall. That's the story here. It's the first major consumer newspaper to put its online content behind a paywall, and the three-month exercise is being closely watched, of course, by everyone, as you just mentioned, Michael, to see what happens to circulation and advertising revenues. Will they decline? Will they go up? 105,000 people pay to access the site digitally, but that's broken down into about 50,000 monthly subscribers, and I guess another 55,000 people who pay by the day. You can pay.
Well, they did it once or twice. They had 100,000 unique, but this is where it gets confusing. Their press release was a little opaque, and what they said was over this three month period.
Yes.
Three month period that the wording was that they had 105,000 or they had 50,000 monthly subscriptions. Sold. I'm sorry, I'm stumbling over my words, but they made it very unclear. They said they had roughly 50,000 subscriptions sold for monthly subscriptions. But then when you look at it, you're certainly not aware whether they're saying they sold a monthly prescription to 50,000 people for all 3 months or whether 50,000 total were sold. It could be 13,000 people bought a monthly subscription and renewed it for the other 2 months. So it's not clear at all that they've sold that 50,000 people have signed on and say, I'm now willing to pay X amount of dollars a month to subscribe to the Times of London. It could be as low as 13,000 or even lower, frankly. If you had a lot of people sign up for a day, say 80,000 people signed up to pay for 1 day's access at a pound, and then you had 20,000 subscriptions left over, and maybe that's split between 4,000 people who were willing to pay a monthly cost. Or maybe some people paid for 1 month and then said, this isn't worth it, and they dropped off. And somebody else did it for 2 months and dropped off. So these figures are so opaque, it's really, really hard to tell exactly.
Well, they say their retention rate, in their defense, they do say their retention rate is quite high. But News International, when they announced it, which is News Corp's, owns the Times of London, this is the way they phrased it. They said that their new digital products for the Times and the Sunday Times have achieved more than 105,000 paid-for customer sales to date. Meaning,
right. So if I paid £1 to access it for one day, that counts as a sale.
Yes.
Don't you think a lot of people paid £1 just to do it once or something or whatever?
Yeah, if they needed something.
So I think it's really much lower than they're talking about. They said that once people pay for a monthly subscription, they're very happy with it, especially on their iPad. But again, they're not giving specific figures. They're giving this sort of a general overall glimpse. And frankly, what the news is that, of course, because they put up the firewall, they're eyeballs are way down. They've lost 90% of their audience.
Well, 90%, not of their audience, of their page views, not of their audience. They actually retained about 2-4% of their audience, which...
Right. They lost 96% of their audience.
Right. And actually, that's about right. When you have a freemium model where you give some away for free and you charge for bonus material or for, broader material or more in-depth material... Usually it's 95% won't pay, 5% will. So that's about right as far as the number of customers they would have gotten if they had been charging all along.
But I have to say they're handling pretty incompetently. I went online to the Times of London to see what they were charging, because if you get a paid subscription to the print edition, you get access to the digital one, obviously. And you go online and you cannot find a way. I couldn't find a way. I have 20 minutes of trying to find out how much it would cost to get a paid print subscription.
Well, TechCrunch, Eric Schoenfeld over at TechCrunch, did a little story on, and he did the math. He said,
but he's wrong. He's making assumptions that he can't. He's assuming that they sold 50,000 people paid for monthly subscriptions for all 3 months, and that's not accurate. You have to cut his estimates by 75% to get a range of what might or might not be true.
Well, wait a second. What he's saying is today, and he did say that he was making assumptions here, and he's saying today, not for the 3 months previous, but today, 50,000 monthly subscribers are paying $12.80.
No, they're not. But that's where he's wrong. He's saying they don't say that 50,000 people are monthly subscribers. They say they've sold 50,000 monthly subscriptions over that 3 month period. Well, that could be 13,000 people if they're being clever.
No, but 50,000 monthly subscribers, okay?
If they had them.
If that's they what had they would, them.
Right.
Paying $12.80 a month would make, we've converted this into dollars instead of pounds, it would make $640,000 a month. And he's kind of giving them the benefit of the doubt, saying that 55,000 pay-as-you-read crowd is generating an additional $160,000 a month. And if you times that, that comes out to about $800,000 a month or $9.6 million a year in online subscription revenues.
To sum it up, he's saying, you know what? You don't need a lot of people to pay money to access your stuff in order to make up for the eyeballs that you lose. He's saying if you do have 50,000 people paying $640,000 a month and you've got the advertising of the other people who come in and out, you can make about $800,000 a month or almost $10 million a year on online subscription revenues. And he argues that that would be better than if you just stuck to the open policy and tried to sell your advertising based on all the eyeballs you have.
Right, and I guess what he's saying is that 41 million estimated page views a month, assuming a $5 cost per thousand impressions, so a $5 advertising rate.
Right, he's saying you make less money.
$200,000, yeah.
Leaving it open. I don't want to freak people out with all the numbers. Then you make less money with people just accessing your website for free than if you do if just 2-4% of them are willing to pony up some dollars.
Wait, so I'm a little confused. Is this story a big deal or not?
It's a big whoop because the Times of London still isn't telling us specific figures.
That's a big segue.
Yes, I always count on Karen to
smell the segue.
Yes, indeed, that is a segue into our popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the week's top entertainment news stories and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. The Hollywood Reporter's first print weekly comes out, and its cover looks a lot like Vanity Fair, featuring famous movie actresses in a glamour shot and sitting for a round table together to discuss the industry. Online, they offered exclusive video of the women chatting. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big deal. It's an interesting step for The Hollywood Reporter, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Michael?
I say it's a big deal, too, though I feel like they're online... site is just losing its industry cred. I mean, the top item a couple hours ago was 8 fun facts you didn't know about Conan O'Brien. And that's not the sort of thing I go to Hollywood Reporter for.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives. Those words open the daytime soap, The Days of Our Lives, and fans will be hearing them for at least 2 years to come. NBC has renewed Days of Our Lives for another 2 years, and it's a sign of how troubled soaps are that this is even news. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's more like it's a big deal, because I'm surprised these soaps aren't being canceled day by day. I'm surprised they think they can still make money off them.
I agree. This is a huge deal. And for exactly what you just said, it's because this is even news.
Which Hollywood stars don't provide enough bang for their buck? Forbes.com tries to quantify that with their annual list of the most overpaid stars in Hollywood. They look at wide releases in the last 5 years for a star, add up their box office, and then estimate how much money the star brought in for every dollar they were paid. In business terms, by the way, we call that return on investment. FYI. Will Ferrell is this year's most overpaid actor thanks to the continued fallout from Land of the Lost. Others on the list include Matt Damon, Eddie Murphy, Drew Barrymore, and Tom Cruise. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
I just love when Forbes does this. I mean, it's actually, this is a big deal. I mean, this is serious. These are overpaid stars by millions of dollars.
Michael?
Ooh, I don't know if you looked at it. I think it's a big whoop. I don't like how they measure movies. They don't include DVD grosses. It's very confusingly and lamely done. And it's just basically an excuse to do a slideshow where you have to click through every star. And it's just badly done on a lot of levels. I don't think it's very smartly done in a business sense, and I don't like it.
Inquiring minds want to know, is the National Enquirer going out of business? Nope, it's just filing for bankruptcy. Maybe they'll run into MGM in court. American Media Inc., the company behind The Enquirer, as well as Star, Shape, and Michael's favorite, Men's Fitness, is reorganizing its debt load and getting creditors to sign on. So their paparazzi isn't going away anytime soon. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. Stabilizes the company for the future. Declaring bankruptcy is the best thing you can do.
Hold on. I'm just making a note of that. And so that I call lawyer.
I agree that this is a big deal. I just can't believe I didn't know about it.
Gwyneth Paltrow sings out on TV this week. First on Tuesday, she performs the cleaned-up radio version of CeeLo Green's foul-mouthed hit Forget You. FYI, he uses a different word on the album. Does begin with the letter F, though. Then on Wednesday, she sings live on the Country Music Television Awards, which ties into Paltrow's new movie, Country Strong, where she plays an out-of-control country singer fighting off the younger, cuter country singers nipping at her heels. People like Taylor Swift. So, Karen, is music star Gwyneth Paltrow a big deal or a big whoop?
I'm so sick of Gwyneth Paltrow. Big whoop.
Yeah, I say it's a big deal. Let's not forget that a decade ago, she had a massive worldwide hit with Huey Lewis on the song Cruisin'.
Yeah, it was a big deal a decade ago. It's not a big deal now.
I'm looking forward to hearing her live country performance, though. I don't know if she's ever done that before. That's got to be incredibly nerve-wracking for her.
Have you heard this song, Forget You, or, you know, F You?
Yeah, who hasn't?
Yeah.
Okay, I was going to play a little piece, but okay, since you both have heard it, we'll just place a link to it in the show notes. And
the whole
actually,
world has heard this.
Okay. William Shatner covers the song on Lopez Tonight.
Put that in our show notes. I'd like to check that out.
Yeah, it's very funny. Lil Wayne, he's been released from jail. He celebrated in pure rapper style, going to an NBA basketball game on Friday, Vegas on Saturday, where he did a song with Drake, and a strip club on Sunday. Of course, we jumped over the fact that he also appeared in court in Arizona on Friday. Our first black president, Bill Clinton, of course, even had some words of welcome for Wayne's return. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because now that he's out of prison, I'm worried that his release schedule of new albums will slow down. He's going to be so busy doing things, he won't be able to focus on his recording career.
Karen?
I thought for sure he'd be murdered because think how much more money his albums would have made.
Here's Bill Clinton on Lil Wayne.
I know this is kind of a funny question for you to ask me,
mm-hmm.
but I think, you know, my daughter introduced me to rap and hip hop music after I said some things she thought were not very smart. She said, "Dad, you need to listen. A lot of these people are smart. This guy's smart, and he's got ability, and he's got a new chance now. And what I hope is that is it not just something to brand him as a cool guy, but that it'll never happen again to him? I think a lot of these people, they don't get successful in that, just like any other area of life, by being really dumb. They're really smart, but a lot of them have had tough lives, and they almost think it's cool to get in trouble every now and then, or they don't know how to stay out. What I hope will happen is that he has a good life now.
Can you believe that was actually Bill Clinton? I mean, he is a master. He is a real master. Yep, that's Michael Jackson singing on that new Michael Jackson song. While when a batch of songs were unearthed that Michael sang on with some relatives, Sony did extensive audio testing to confirm that it was indeed the King of Pop vocalizing on the tracks. They are the centerpiece of the new album of songs from The Vault being released in December. In other Michael news, Sony is releasing a lavish 3-DVD set, all of his music, videos, and short films, while Cirque du Soleil says its Michael Jackson show will begin touring next fall. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
I say it's a big deal because they're grabbing these tracks from these relatives that he just sang over some, you know, some musical tracks that they laid down. And they're so desperate for new material because he does not have a lot of music in the vaults. So that's why this is kind of telling.
He had the nerve to go ahead and die. I mean, geez.
Yeah, but he's not one of those people who, like Prince or Bob Dylan, you can put out albums for decades after they go because they have so much stuff in the vault. Michael Jackson does not have a lot of quality stuff in the vault.
In the old days, record labels would spend hundreds of thousands and even $1 million or more on a music video and then beg MTV to play it. In fact, I worked on a Michael Jackson music video that cost $4 million, directed by David Fincher. Now, MTV is starting to pay for music videos itself. In a new series called Super Video, MTV teams with directors and top actors to create cool new cutting-edge videos it can air on its network, hoping to recapture some of the mojo from its glory days and steal the thunder of YouTube, where Lady Gaga can score millions of hits, in fact, billions. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I wouldn't say it's a big deal, but I personally find it sort of interesting.
I think it's a big deal as far as the changing of the times. It's kind of amazing that they have to fund new videos themselves, especially since they have been showing them for years.
Well, maybe kids are staying online and watching music videos. They're certainly not going to concerts. The touring business has been, or the touring biz, as it we refer to it here on Showbiz Sandbox, has been hurting for a few years now thanks to bloated ticket prices. Now a new study suggests young people have lost the habit of going to see live music completely. According to Edison Research, the crucial habit-forming demo of 12 to 24-year-olds goes to less than one concert a year compared to the average 2.1 concerts they attended a decade ago. An entire generation simply may never be accustomed to going to see live music. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's definitely a big deal because this is when habits are formed and artists are supposed to make all their money off concert tours since nobody's buying CDs anymore. So now what do they do?
Well, it's also indicative of how expensive concerts are. They can't afford to go. And chances are someone's going to bootleg it and put it on YouTube anyway. So it's like being there, but closer.
Elton John gives up. He throws in the towel. Yep, Elton John says he can't compete with the kids anymore when it comes to rock and roll. Look, I'm 63. I don't want to be on VH1 or MTV. I'm not going to compete with JLS or Lady Gaga, Sir Elton told the BBC. I'm at the stage where I don't think I can write pop music anymore. I can't sit down and do a proper rock song. It was okay when I was 25 or 26, but not anymore. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big deal. He's an icon. I'm devastated.
Well, he's not stopping. It's a big whoop because he's being silly. He's not stopping to write music, and he's been a force on the adult contemporary charts for the last two decades.
And he always will.
And as his rock career, you know, subsides. Plus, he's got two massive hits on Broadway, Billy Elliot and The Lion King, which played to, you know, gross hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, he's as much, and he's got a new album, The Union, that just came out with Leon Russell that Rolling Stone gave 5 stars to. He's as much a creative force as ever. But yeah, as you get older, you segue from rock and roll to more mature adult pop. It happens. It'll be all right. I wonder if they've ever done a university course on Elton John's music, though. There's an item here about the University of South Carolina.
Yes, the University of South Carolina is going to start teaching an academic module about Lady Gaga called Lady Gaga and the Sociology of the Fame. The course will be taught by Professor Matthew Deflam, who claims to have seen the singer live 28 times. Deflam, although he didn't say whether she was singing at the time, Deflam said that he was originally going to use Lady Gaga as an example in the course before deciding she was worthy of study in her own right. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
I know that a lot of people mock this kind of thing. Like, was it Michigan that had a Madonna course? But pop culture is worth studying. It says so much about our culture. I think that people can mock this, but I think it's a really good way to study popular culture.
Well, I'll agree with you because you're right. I mean, done intelligently, you can analyze anything from a children's Saturday morning television show to, you know, done properly. It can be substantial. But I wonder if Professor Matthew Deflam also runs their theater course. He's been to see her 28 times.
Yeah, it's a little weird. But, I mean, he seems to be a sociology professor. I think that yeah. would yes. I think it would be a really interesting class to look at and to study her from a sociological perspective. Maybe that's just the key.
Yeah, and you'd use it to introduce a lot of terms and ideas that are substantial and meaningful and rather than just go, oh, look at her video,
look at the
great costume.
And that's how you get kids to, you know, to retain things and to be interested. You teach them through something yeah. that they know and care about.
Spider-Man, turn off the start date. Yes, the mega musical Spider-Man, turn off the dark. I'm going to have to, like, practice that voice. Well, it's delayed its opening again, this time till January, in the midst of stories about stunt actors getting injured and breaking bones, while director Julie Taymor fine-tunes the show's stunts and seeks approval from city inspectors. The show, which includes songs by Bono and The Edge of U2, cost some $60 million, most expensive Broadway production ever, and it won't begin previews for another 3 weeks, and now opens in early January, missing both Thanksgiving and December, the holiday season. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it won't miss the December season. It will be in previews. It just won't have opened by then. I say it's a big whoop because at this stage, all that matters is the show that you deliver, whether you open in November or January. This is a show that needs to run for 3 or 4 years to make money. So what matters is getting it right. So it's a big whoop that they've delayed it because they need to get it right. What matters is what it's like on opening night.
Karen?
No, I agree. I agree.
And yet it looks like a train wreck.
And yet it clearly looks like a train wreck.
I like the fact that the health department has to come and
that's a little weird, right?
All the stunts to make sure that the stunts are...
No, it's not weird because you have like fire. You set a bed on fire and women on the verge of a nervous breakdown, that musical. So they would have to inspect that and make sure it was safe. If you have actors going on trapezes and flying across the stage, you're going to have a safety inspector in there to check it. So it's very standard. They've got a lot of heavy equipment going on Broadway shows. Even a simple seeming show can be quite dangerous.
Especially when you spend $60 million on it. That's probably the most
dangerous kind
of Broadway show. Well, Karen, I know you've got to run before we do Inside Baseball, but our Inside Baseball topic sticks with actors. In fact, Michael, we're going to be talking to Jonathan Handel. Karen, thank you for joining us this week.
Bye, guys.
Bye. It's just not the same without her.
Well, but we'll have Jonathan Handel to play with. I mean, talk to.
Do you think he'll talk in a high voice and act like Karen?
Well, Michael, I highly doubt just because Karen left that Jonathan Handel will be talking in a high voice you can ask him, but you know, you have to keep in mind, he is of counsel at Troy Gould, where he practices digital media, entertainment, and technology law. And of course, he's a contributing editor to The Hollywood Reporter, and he's joining us now. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm wearing all my hats.
Michael was wondering if you'd talk in a high voice since Karen had to leave, so.
That one I'll have to defer on.
I think that shows a good soberness. Before we edge into this week's news, I wonder what your reaction was to the news about the deal that was struck over The Hobbit in New Zealand.
Well, that's an interesting one. It really shows the power that a multinational corporation has, a multinational studio in this case, when a small nation needs the money, needs the production, $500 million production. There's only about 4 million people in the country, actually. So even just measured on on that sort of basis, it's a big deal. And it was a very dramatic story, I have to say. You know, the government ministers, the prime minister and others were on television and radio and newspapers every day for a good 2 weeks or so. And we really saw just how dynamic labor relations can be overseas as well as here.
Did the concessions made by the government to sort of make Warner Brothers, make the studios feel comfortable with the deal and moving it to film there, did they seem exceptionally unprecedented to you or unusual?
Well, they were unusual. Now, whether it's a good deal or not is something that I'll leave up to New Zealanders to thrash out. What they did get in return, and what the deal was, by the way, is that Warner's gets an extra $25 million in production incentives above and beyond the 50 some odd they already qualified for under existing programs. And they also got the New Zealand Parliament to pass a law making it effectively impossible to unionize the film industry in that country. So, you know, very, very much unprecedented. The Labour Party complained that this was the sort of thing that goes on in a banana republic like Fiji. Shouldn't go on in New Zealand. So there's obviously a lot of, South Pacific politics there. But the what they did get in return, they being the New Zealand government, is an agreement by Warners that there will be promotional video about New Zealand as a tourist and filming destination included on every DVD and electronic download copies of the Hobbit movies. And, you know, that is big. The Lord of the Rings, which The Hobbit, of course, is a prequel to, drove a lot of tourism to that country. There were whole campaigns and Air New Zealand.
Package tours, yeah.
Yeah, tours and, you know, come visit the real Middle Earth and all that kind of thing. And it's a country whose, I think, 10% of their GDP is tourism. So it makes a big difference.
Well, that's what New Zealand got out of a deal with Warner Brothers for The Hobbit. In the United States, and I guess I can't say North America since SAG and AFTRA are really just here in the United States. I know I'm about to be proven wrong by that. But what did the actors get in their new contract with the producers, the studios, and networks in this case?
Well, first of all, you're exactly right. SAG and AFTRA are United States only.
Yes.
You scored on that one, my friend. And the unions got something of a score and something of a compromise. On the one hand, the annual wage increases for each year of the 3-year deal are 2%. Now, you know, on the one hand, that's scarcely more than half what they were last time. They were getting 3.5%. But last time was a different economy. And of course, in this economy, to get any wage increase is, you know, has got to be counted as a good thing.
And they're sort of keeping pace with inflation, sort of barely there. They're just not, they're sort of making sure they don't lose money year to year.
Yeah, it is effectively sort of a cost of living adjustment and nothing much more than that, I think. Although I don't know the exact inflation figures. It's certainly better than what you get by putting money in the bank these days. I mean, it's, you know, we're in a very weird economy. There's no doubt about that. And the entertainment industry, as much as any other industry, is dealing with tough times.
Well, in the Hollywood Reporter, you said this deal is all about bread and butter and little else. I was wondering if you could explain what you meant by that.
Well, bread and butter issues. First of all, the wages that we just talked about. Secondly, the other thing that's been difficult for the unions in this economy has been the health of their pension and health plans, no pun intended. Those plans are financed primarily by contributions that are made by the employers as a percentage of the wages that they pay employees. So there's been less work for people. That means the contributions are lower. Pension assets, the investment assets aren't doing so well. Healthcare costs are soaring and, you know, and on and on. Usually, the pension and health plans get a 0.5% increase, so a 0.5% increase as a one-shot increase during the 3-year contract. This time, they got a 1.5% increase, 3 times what's typical or at most typical. So that was a big get for the unions. But what they didn't get and what they didn't, you know, weren't able to get is much else of any great substance. I mean, there certainly were some improvements. There was a slight improvement in new media, increasing union jurisdiction a little bit, but not much. So this is, as I say, it was about bread and butter issues, wages and pension and health, and didn't really, you know, there are a lot of other smaller details that most of which haven't been released. But there's nothing earth-shattering that's going to break the bank dramatically.
Now, their current contract will expire in June of next year, 2011. One of the big concessions they made on their current contract was in new media, that they didn't really get anything in new media. And they said, well, we'll get it next time because, of course, that's where all the money's going to be. So why didn't they bargain harder for more participation in new media?
Because the economy sucks.
Well, because the economy sucks, and because new media sucks, to put it in a crass sort of way, and I mean that not from the standpoint of a viewer or audience member, but economically, the money is not in new media, not yet. It is still much smaller area than traditional media. That will presumably, almost certainly, eventually change, but the combination of that and the fact that, you know, Michael, as you say, that the economy is in bad shape. And that, and the pension and health plans are in troubled, you know, shape. They're under pressure. Meant that that wasn't where the focus was. And of course, they did get, you know, something in new media last time around. I mean, that was the big, that was the first time that they got a comprehensive new media program. Now, you know, program of residuals and so forth and jurisdiction. It wasn't everything that everyone wanted, but last negotiating cycle was about getting that initial foothold. And perhaps then some in new media. This negotiating cycle was about wages and benefits.
It's somewhat important that SAG and AFTRA have closed this deal with the AMPTP.
Well, that's right. What's going on next is this. First of all, this week, SAG, but not AFTRA, is negotiating basic cable, several different basic cable and related contracts with the studios. So it's a 1 week, overtime session, as it were. These are contracts that kind of tack on to the main contract that they just finished with. Next week, the Directors Guild is up. They make their deals quickly, and they've been having, it's understood they've been having informal discussions already with the studios. They said that, at least that's what they said they were going to be doing, and that's what they always do. What we will see, I think, is a deal that's made quickly. It'll be at the 2% wage level. They'll get the 1.5% pension and health as well. All the pension and health plans from all the guilds are under the same pressure. This is called pattern bargaining. There's no law that says that they are entitled to or have to be given or get exactly what the first union got. But as a matter of business practice, that's what happens. They'll also get a variety of things that are director specific, just as the actors have gotten a variety of things here that are actor specific. And then they'll call it a day. Now, the Writers Guild is a more difficult situation. They haven't scheduled negotiations yet. Their contract expires a little earlier. The directors and SAGA and AFTRA, as you say, expire June 30th. But the writers expire May 1st of next year. They're probably not going to start negotiation, well, not till February at the earliest, but probably not until mid-March. So there'll be some stockpiling of scripts probably. There'll be some brinksmanship. But at the end of the day, you know, they're going to end up with the same economic terms plus some writer-specific issues that the other two unions three unions have ended up with.
I don't think the writers can afford to go on strike again. They went on strike 2007, 2008.
That's right.
I don't think they can do it again.
No, they can't. I mean, they went on strike during that period, and then SAG had a stalemate, essentially a de facto strike for a year or more that ended in mid 2009. So the entire industry is a bit beat up and tired of strikes and stalemates. I think they'll either get a deal done by the May 1st deadline, or they may end up working, you know, without a contract for a number of weeks or even months. That's happened before. So the industry, you know, is probably going to end up biting some of its collective nails, being a little bit on edge in the spring. Ultimately, I don't think we'll see a labor disturbance. Meanwhile, SAG and AFTRA now have 2011 free to talk about merger, which was probably going to be your next question. And maybe I'm anticipating, but the unions have talked about and attempted to merge multiple times over decades, many decades, most recently in the past 10 years, and they came close. This time the stars may be aligned. That's certainly what the leadership is hoping. And the SAG leadership that's in control now, the moderate leadership, ran on a platform that was essentially merger, merger, merger. You know, the issue here is, what sense does it make to have two separate actors' unions? The actors have to pay two sets of dues. They have a harder time qualifying for pension and health care because there are dollar thresholds in terms of earnings that you have to meet. And if your earnings are split between two unions, you may fall below those thresholds in both unions. And, you know, and on it goes. So there's been this logic to merger for a long time. That's easier said than done. There are a lot of technical issues in terms of how to merge pension plans, for example. Very complicated actuarial issues and pragmatic issues, even going down to what would the name of the merged union be.
Do the media companies want to see them merge, or do they like to have them split?
Excellent question. I'm glad you went there. You know, the media companies get some advantage out of having each of these unions as split and as weak as potentially sort of can be without literally breaking the union. AFTRA right now has most new primetime television programming. That's an artifact or a result of the fact that SAG stalemated for a year. So the hardliners in SAG who hate AFTRA, in fact, were the best thing that had happened to AFTRA in many years. SAG has all film, theatrical motion picture, because AFTRA simply doesn't have jurisdiction there. The media companies do gain by being able to play the unions off against each other to some extent and by not having unity there. Which raises an interesting question when it comes to merger of pension and health plans, because those plans are actually jointly controlled by the industry, the companies, and the unions. Under federal labor law, they have to be set up that way. You can't have a plan that's, as I understand it, that's just controlled by the union. The question becomes, will the company representatives on the board of directors of these plans make things difficult, make it difficult to merge the plans? very complicated politics. They may. It's hard to know.
Well, Jonathan Handel, thank you for unraveling the new contract that SAG and AFTRA signed with the producers and studios. Your work can be found on The Hollywood Reporter and also on your own website, Digital Media Law. And you also have a Twitter account. Jay Handel is the username to look up. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you. That's right, Jay Handel, and also jhandel.com. And I'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, that was good of Jonathan Handel to stop by. As he clarified, of course, these deals aren't literally signed, sealed, and delivered. They have to go to the board and then to the members, but everybody expects them to sail through.
Well, yes, and it's just I guess the importance there is that there will not be another strike, at least with actors.
Yeah, that's certainly for fans of movies and television, that's certainly good news.
Well, if you're a fan of this podcast, you can subscribe to it in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. You can rate it there as well. You can also subscribe via RSS. You can visit our website to find links to all the stories we discussed on today's episode. You can also leave comments there, or you can email us. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us as well. Leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND is the number to call. That's 888-567-7263. On our website, you'll also find links to all of our social networking accounts. What do we have? Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, you name it. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each podcast is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Karen Woodward is on her website, karenwoodwardonline.com, or on Twitter, @Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. Michael Giltz can be found not only at the Huffington Post from time to time, but also on his website, michaelgiltz.com.
That always makes me feel like I'm in Tron or something when you say I can be found on my website. I feel like I'm embedded in the code.
Well, that's definitely not how I mean it. But you also are on Twitter. @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. I'm on Twitter. @Sperling is my username. And some of my writing can be found on the blog Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.